I am Plante on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's been a couple of weeks since the Trudeau government gave its approval of expanding the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline a week or so ago. Vancouver'sAwesome.com featured pieces from Kai Nagata and Max Fawcett, one opposing the decision, the other arguing in favor. When I saw the post on Bob Kronbauer's Facebook, I figured there should be a little more discussion. I invited both Mr. Fawcett and Mr. Nagata to join me to talk about pipeline politics, the political fallout from this decision, the coast itself and how it'll be affected, and the wider national implications. We've heard and read a lot online and elsewhere in the last number of days, and it'll add to the discussion by beginning a conversation here. I'll get them to reflect on the political context, not only at home but abroad, as well as how the debate in the coming days and years will unfold. What sources, people, or organizations are the messers Nagata and Fawcett relying upon in what will doubtless be an energetic debate? Max Fawcett is a journalist and freelance writer. He is the former editor of Vancouver Magazine and Alberta Oil. He's on Twitter, and the handle is at Max Fawcett. He, like Kai Nagata, was born in Vancouver. Kai is communications director at Dogwood Initiative, a citizens' action organization. He is a former journalist. His Twitter handle is at Kai Nagata. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program, Max Fawcett and Kai Nagata. Mr. Nagata, good morning.
Morning. Good to be back.
And Mr. Fawcett, good morning.
Good morning as well.
Thanks for coming in and braving the rain, the snow bombs to get here. Friday, the eight of the premiers and the federal government signed this agreement with regards to, they call it a historic climate framework. What does this mean? And I guess this is a good way of getting into our discussion on pipelines. I mean, what have you noticed in terms of I guess the details? We don't know what the details are yet, do we, Kai?
We don't know the exact numbers, yeah. But we can say broadly that this is the first time in 28 years that a Canadian government has actually put a plan together to fight climate change. It's the first time they've had a majority of premiers on board, and it looks like, other than Brad Wall, they'll probably get at least nine of the provinces and the territories on board, and so that's a huge step forward. It sounds like something that's going to buy more political cover for increased fossil fuel expansion if Mr. Trudeau can demonstrate that it fits within his overall carbon budget. And a big part of that is going to involve buying carbon credits from developing countries.
I guess what I'm really wondering about, Max, is does it mean that me as a taxpayer, at the end of the day, am I going to have to... Well, I already pay a carbon tax, don't I?
You do in BC, yeah. It's a $30 per ton carbon tax. So, I mean, in BC, it's not really going to change anything. It's really more about bringing, you know, the other provinces into the fold as far as putting a price on carbon. And then, you know, I think the important thing is making sure that price is consistent across the country. You have Alberta has announced it's going to put a carbon tax in place. BC has one. But Quebec and Ontario are going the cap and trade route. And the concern expressed by Premier Clark yesterday when she, I think, kind of, you know, I don't want to say held up the meetings, but mm-hmm. but definitely exercised her prerogative, was that, you know, we can't have a situation where Ontario and Quebec have a de facto lower price on carbon than BC and Alberta, because then you're going to see businesses, you know, theoretically moving there. It you know, will draw investment out of the West and into the East, and that obviously sort of harkens back to the National Energy Program a little bit. So there's certainly some fine-grained detail that needs to be worked out here, but I think, you know, as far as a political commitment goes, I mean, Brad Wall can piss and moan all he wants. This is going to happen.
It's a kind of a funny argument for Clark to make, because that's exactly the case right now, is that people in BC pay a $30 a ton carbon tax, and it hasn't hampered BC's economic growth. It hasn't hampered our job creation. In fact,
I didn't even notice it. That's why I'd ask him if we were paying for it, if I was paying for one.
Yeah, right? So her issue is she doesn't want it to go up further before the other provinces had a chance to catch up. Yeah. But at the moment, you know, we're $30 a ton ahead of the other provinces, and it hasn't been a big drag on the economy.
So her signing on, does that mean anything in terms of, say, political foreshadowing as to how she feels about the Kinder Morgan project?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, she... You know, she's always walked this very interesting line where, you know, she claims that she has these conditions that she's holding, you know, the federal government to account for.
What's the number now, five or something like that?
I think it's still five, but, you know, very vague, very broad, so that, of course, you can fit anything into them if you want to. I mean, she never had the constitutional authority to prevent a pipeline from coming here, but it was an interesting bit of political theater to make it seem like she did. And I think she's going to use this issue to try to split the NDP in the provincial election, because the NDP is this very interesting coalition of, you know, urban, left-wing, progressive environmentalists, and then in the interior and the other parts of BC, a little more working class, a little less, I would say, concerned about carbon pricing, for example. And I think she's going to try to use the pipeline to kind of undermine the position that John Horgan has taken. But we'll see if that works.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a pretty clear swing to the right ahead of the provincial election by Ms. Clark. If she's already got a clear differentiator on the pipeline issue between her and the opposition, she might as well also try to hold up the, you know, a rise in the carbon tax. That's something that, you know, old SoCred right-wing voters would applaud her for. And I think you're going to see her try to carve out a clear sort of right versus left playing field in this election and use her massive financial advantage and troops on the ground to try and crush the NDP and secure a mandate for all of the fossil fuel development that she's already got on the books.
So where does the NDP and John Horgan, where do they, I mean, what do they do now between now and May?
I mean, they've belatedly come out, I would say, and taken a strong position against the pipeline, but it took a little bit of prodding from people like Kai, basically, to get them to clarify what their stance was on it. It's a tricky line for them to walk, because the NDP is, you know, is always vulnerable on the jobs issue and on the economy. It's a little bit unfair, but it's a corner that they've been painted into by their opponents.
They've allowed themselves to wear that the decades.
There's some degree of deservingness, that's not a word, but you know, they own that a little bit. And the Liberals are going to say, we're good for the economy, they're bad, and they're going to link the pipeline stuff to it. It's up to the NDP to craft an alternative narrative around, you know, this isn't about saying no to jobs, this is about saying no to, environmental degradation, you know, transgression of First Nations rights, et cetera, and time will tell how that plays with the electorate.
Yeah, bottom line, if this election is about, you know, material insecurity, Christy Clark is going to put money in your pocket. The NDP is going to make the future more uncertain. She wins.
Yeah.
If it's about corruption, if it's about housing, if it's about, you know, international money flowing into either our political system or the real estate market, you know, and the steps that Christy Clark has taken to grow the economy at the expense of affordability in the Lower Mainland and, you know, the expense of the environment, then I think you could see a populist backlash exactly like what took down Hillary Clinton.
And this is why it was just such a missed opportunity for the NDP not to have David Eby as their leader going into this, because he would be able to marshal those arguments and that issue far more effectively than John Horgan can. You know, in a lot of respects, I think Horgan's the wrong leader for this moment in history.
So if just thinking of the environment as the critical issue of that campaign, then where's the Green Party of BC and its place in all of this?
Well, they're chewing big chunks out of the NDP.
Yeah.
You know, in ridings on the southern Vancouver Island, and we may see their numbers rise in the Lower Mainland in the wake of this Kinder Morgan approval, depending how vigorously the NDP can present itself as an alternative to Ms. Clark that can actually govern. So yeah, you're seeing the Greens putting a huge amount of pressure on Horgan's NDP on Kinder Morgan. I think that was a major factor, probably more than Dogwood, although I'm flattered, in getting them to take a clear position in opposition to the pipeline. And you're going to see on the big money issue, you know, the Greens are continuing to hammer John Horgan for holding these resource industry dinners, $10,000 a plate, that kind of a thing, now that they've stopped taking big money from campaign contributors. So you're going to continue seeing the Greens trying to find every angle with which to attack the NDP, and that's a greater danger, I would say, to their being able to form a governing coalition from their perspective than the battle against Ms. Clark.
And I think that's why the Liberals and Premier Clark, they kind of want to invite the NDP to make this about the environment a little bit, because, you know, and about pipelines, because then they can play the jobs card, but it also opens the door for the Greens to come around on their other flank and say, hey, you're actually not doing enough. You know, here are all the times in the past where you have, you know, legislated or invaded in, you know, in ways that are not great for the environment. And it's just sort of they're caught between these two sort of flanking armies. Whereas if they'd gone more the corruption route, the housing market route, you know, they're a little more unimpeachable on that one. You know, the Greens can't really get a good look at their left and the Liberals, I think, are far more vulnerable on that issue. But that ship has sailed.
This approval of the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline on November 28th, did that surprise you, Kai? Because you've since circulated a video online of you talking to Justin Trudeau, the candidate. When was that, about a year or so ago? No, more than a year ago, right?
Yeah, that was last August.
Yeah, so this is before the election.
It didn't surprise me, but it still annoyed me.
Yeah. So did because at the same time, they canceled Northern Gateway.
Yeah.
And then there's one out east, too, isn't there? That there or Central
there's
Canada.
There's line three that would go through the prairies.
So what do you think motivated Justin Trudeau and his government to do what they did?
I think it's what I call Goldilocks politics, right? Trudeau's favorite place to be is right between the NDP and the Conservatives. If they're both criticizing him on opposite sides of an issue, the Conservatives are saying, no, you should have built two pipelines to the West Coast. And the NDP is saying, no, you should have built zero. He says, great, how about one? Canadians understand that we need to find a balance. We need to find compromise. Jobs and the environment go together. So as long as he can walk that line between those two opposition parties, I think he's exactly where he wants to be. And on the pipeline issue, he played it perfectly.
And so when you think about what that means here in terms of his, well, I'm assuming that he'll run again 3 years from now. The Liberals won 17 seats out of 42 in British Columbia. What does that mean? I mean, how many of those has he lost as a result of this decision?
Well, this actually brings in another big topic that we don't have to get into fully, but that's electoral reform. Because the outcome of this question hinges entirely on what voting system we head into the next election with. So the current system, first past the post, actually allows people in a very concentrated geographic area to punish members of parliament. It also creates the vote splitting phenomenon that we've been talking about since the last election, where if the progressive vote fragments, if Trudeau's NDP voters and Green voters and young voters and first time voters who came out for him in 2015, if those people evaporate, stay home, vote for other parties, then a lot of those seats fall to Conservatives. But this is really going to depend on what kind of voting system they choose for the 2019 election. And the damage that will take in BC, I think, is dependent on that outcome.
Yeah, it's funny, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kai, but I think the NDP is pretty consistent in wanting a proportional system. But in BC, a proportional system might actually protect the Liberals in 2019 a little more than a first past the post would. Because
yeah, it dilutes that local impact. And in fact, the Conservatives and the Greens would have done better under a proportional system in 2015 in British Columbia. The NDP would have done worse, and the Liberals would have lost a couple.
Yeah, I mean, I think the notion that they're going to lose all their seats in BC is a little bit overwrought. There are some of those seats that they shouldn't have really won anyways, and we're going to probably give back in 2019 no matter what happens. So, the North Vancouver riding, the Burnaby riding, those were, I don't think anyone in Liberal HQ was penciling those ones in particularly sharp outlines for 2019.
Especially not Burnaby North Seymour. I mean, the scuttlebutt there is that there were no resources at the end of the campaign from the central party because they didn't expect to win in those ridings, right? Like Terry Beach door knocked their way to victory. Basically, pure elbow grease in the riding was enough to put a couple of those candidates over the top where the party didn't even expect to win.
But I think on electoral reform, he promised in the election, Trudeau, that this would be the last first past the post. I think, aren't we really?
He promised a lot of things.
Yeah, so aren't we a little late, though, on the electoral reform thing? I think we'll still have the same system
three years
from now.
They could do it if they wanted to.
Yeah.
They don't want to do it. Yeah. They could not have made, I can swear, right?
You can, yeah.
They could not have made a bigger clusterfuck of this file. Like, it's just, and it shouldn't have been.
No, but it was deliberate.
I don't think the clusterfuck was deliberate. I think they wanted to rag the puck. I think they wanted to kind of bury this in procedure and be able to come out and say, well, we tried.
I think as soon as the elections commissioner came out and said, if you don't have legislation by the spring of 2017, I can't turn this around, right?
Yeah.
You need to redraw the riding boundaries. You need new ballots. So unless you come up with something, then that was the deadline. And they knew if we can rag the puck up to spring 2017 without a consensus, then we don't have to fulfill this promise and we can blame it on the opposition.
But there's skilled puck ragging and there's incompetent puck ragging. And this is pretty incompetent puck ragging, like the survey and the mail outs and
the website.
Yeah. And then, the minister going, the math stuff. And then the minister going in the house and blaming the committee members for not doing their job. Like, it's just, it really, hasn't been
sad
good.
To me. Putting a rookie cabinet minister out in front of this is, I don't know, I just think that's a rough way to treat your bright young stars as the prime minister. He's the one who made the promise, right? Yeah. But the person who's going to have to wear this is this, you know, bright young female.
Yeah, and she's sunk now, right? I mean, she has no real future after all of this, right?
There are always second acts in Canadian public life. I mean, there's been ministers in the past who you would have said, you know, they're written off, and then 5 years later they reemerge. And
she's also proved her loyalty, so that's worth something. Yeah. But I mean, at considerable expense to her own standing, I would say, and respect of other parties.
The thing about electoral reform that I think we have to be mindful of is it gets us excited. It gets people who care about politics and public life excited. I'm not sure that it resonates with the average voter. I'm not sure they care. I'm not sure they even understand to a large degree why this is important. And so I think, you know, like there's a lot of heat in Ottawa and in sort of in the media. But once you get away from that, you know, the elites, quote unquote, I'm not sure that they get as upset about breaking this promise.
If it's as simple as the governing party basically just trying to rig the system in their own favor, that people can understand.
Yeah.
So, for example, if they ram through legislation bringing in, you know, a ranked ballot with single-member districts in the new year, I think people would pretty clearly figure that, okay, this is a system to keep Liberals in power in perpetuity. And I think regardless of the details, that doesn't sit well with anybody. You know, you don't mess with our democratic system just for your own political advantage. So if that's what the story becomes, and I think the opposition is definitely trying to make that the story, then it could do them a lot of damage.
So where the public is, I think, is important, and this will be a great way to get back to pipelines. I guess you folks at Dogwood, didn't you have an Insights West poll recently as to how British Columbians feel about this?
Yeah, well, we asked about this in the week, I guess, leading up to the approval. Just people who voted for the Liberal Party in 2015, did they consider an approval to be contrary to what Trudeau had promised? And, you know, as much as Ottawa has a hard time believing that this is a contradiction, for the people who were receiving the messaging, attending the town halls, talking to candidates in BC, they didn't think they were voting for a pipeline. And that's the uncomfortable gap between what was coming out of Terry Beach's mouth and Jonathan Wilkinson and Jody Wilson-Raybould and all of these high-profile BC members of caucus, you know, in their campaign, did everything they could to downplay the possibility that there would be a pipeline approval a year later. And so that's what I think created the whiplash for, you know, progressive and climate-friendly voters who thought that the Liberals were on their side on the pipeline issue. And so, yeah, I think it was a contradiction. 58% of the people who voted Liberal said that it would be a contradiction. And there are a pretty healthy chunk, about 3 out of 10 voters who did vote for the Liberals last time, who told Insights West that they'd be less likely to cast their ballot for Trudeau's party again if they approve Kinder Morgan. So we'll see if that translates to real damage 3 years from now. A poll is just a snapshot. And I think a lot of that has to do with what happens in the next 3 years, what happens on those construction sites, whether there's a referendum, what happens in the BC election. So there's a lot of twists and turns ahead that will affect how much damage this does to Trudeau.
Yeah, I mean, this is for anyone who cares about politics and you know, geeks out about this stuff, this is just such a fascinating thing. And I know people are upset about the pipeline, and I'm not diminishing their anger or their emotion. I'm just saying, as someone who's always followed politics, it's like a great petri dish, because you have all these competing theories of what's going to happen, and we'll find out who's right. The Liberals are banking on the fact that, you know, the anger that's being expressed right now is largely coming from people who didn't vote for them anyway. Certainly there's some, but, you know,
there's Wade Davis, who endorsed Trudeau, came out very disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to lose a few of the people who thought that the Liberals were the lesser of the evil in the last election. But
as,
you know,
memories of Harper fade for a lot of those progressive voters, you know, they're going to focus on what is consistent, what has remained the same about Ottawa in the wake of that transition in power. And there's a certain point at which you can no longer blame the guy who came before you for your decisions as a government.
No, but he will, though, won't he?
Well, no, and I think the thing to remember is, you know, so you have the BC election that will bleed off, I think, some of the anger, because the premier is a supporter of the pipeline, and she'll absorb some of that. You know, and then we're talking about 3 years, which is a long time in politics. I mean, I remember when people were outraged that the Liberals promised to get rid of the GST and then they didn't. Mm-hmm. And people were like, well, that's going to be the death of them in the next election. And they was not the death of them at all.
Yeah, but the GST was not Standing Rock, right? The GST was not like a TV-friendly standoff between local people and the military, right? Which is one possible scenario over the next 3 years leading into
the
election.
That's what the natural resources minister says. He's bringing in the military.
There's people on both sides that are pushing for confrontation, right? Yeah. And I'm on the side of pipeline opponents, waving my arms and saying, like, this is terrible. There's no way that, you know, pipeline opponents can keep the moral high ground and win if they push for, you know, confrontation with police and God forbid the military. But you know, there's people on both sides spoiling for a fight on this. And so if those are the pictures on the national every night, you know, throughout the campaign as bulldozers roll over the good mayor of Burnaby or whatever, that's a bad thing for the person whose responsibility that decision was.
I would say there's far more people on one side spoiling for a fight than the other. I think the Liberals, and certainly the pipeline companies and everyone in the energy sector, well, you know, with the exception of Ezra Levant and jackasses like that, but sane people in the energy sector and certainly the Liberals, they do not want a confrontation.
Kelly Leach is the front runner in the conservative leadership race, you know, and she published her 5-point plan. Basically lock up pipeline protesters, start your own special police force to target First Nations and environmental advocates, you know, and go back to the Harper program of targeted CRA audits and classify all of this as political lobbying so that you can send in the federal auditors. So that's a pretty aggressive stance in favor of pipeline development that I think has an audience. You know, I don't know if it's more than 20 or 30% of the population, but there are people with an authoritarian streak in BC and Alberta who would love to see those people pepper sprayed, locked up, thrown in paddy wagons.
There are, but and this is sort of, I think, another part of the Liberal strategy is that, let's say Kelly Leach is the conservative, you know, the leader of the Conservative Party going into the next election, or Kevin O'Leary, someone who's, you know, one of these candidates who, you know, is pushing this very sort of extreme message about locking up protesters. Imagine how good Trudeau suddenly looks to people. He suddenly looks like the reasonable adult in the room. You know, maybe the NDP is pushing hard for, you know, conflict. The Conservatives are pushing for conflict. And Trudeau can kind of stand above it and go, look, folks, I'm the adult in the room. Let's, you know,
it's
I want to do this properly.
Goldilocks politics, right?
Yeah.
Right in the middle. Porridge isn't too hot or too cold.
The role of First Nations in all of this, I mean, that's something that, Kai, that you wrote about in your piece on VancouversAwesome.com. That's something that's quickly being overlooked by a lot of people. I mean, and we shouldn't, right?
I had a conversation with Christy Clark about a year and a half ago that was illuminating and interesting. You know, there's a lot of things that I agree with her on. And she wanted to talk about the Japanese internment, right? Because my grandparents spent the war years in a prison camp. And she talked about how her family did what they could to look after the fishing boats of their neighbors during this dark chapter in BC history when civil liberties were suspended and people's property was confiscated. And, you know, I believe she believes in rights and she believes in civil liberty and she believes in women's rights specifically, right? She's a big advocate against violence against children and women. Mm-hmm. And the issue of consent is the one where I think she could be, you know, making a big mistake if she takes the federal government's consultation thus far with First Nations as her own and the basis for her province, her provincial government's approval. Because there's something fundamentally uncomfortable about abandoning the prospect of getting consent for a project and just trying to push it through anyway. And I think that, you know, pipelines are the one issue in Canada that has really brought this to a head, because you can always, you know, relocate a gravel pit or mitigate the effects of a sewage plant or, you know, most projects in the world, you can find some common ground and mitigate people's concerns. But pipelines are one of those issues where, you know, if it's going to go through somebody's territory, you can't be half pregnant on pipelines, right? It's either going through or it's not. And there are people who are not convinced by the arguments that the proponent has made so far and have denied their consent. So what do you do if you can't get those people on board? And, you know, that's where I think the biggest legal battle is going to be is over the interpretation of the government's duty to consult. And I happen to interpret it one way, and I think that obviously the lawyers for the Natural Resources Ministry interpret it another way. But I just feel uncomfortable as a British Columbian, you know, and as somebody who in living memory has had my family's rights denied, the idea that you would say, okay, well, in this case, we're going to override your constitutional rights, and in this case, we're going to ignore your lack of consent, and we're just going to build the thing. And that's a heavy price to pay as a country, I think, if we decide to go down that path.
So Max, I guess the even though the federal government has approved this thing, this could get tied up by the courts, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was in the days after the government announced their approval of Kinder Morgan of the Trans Mountain expansion. I had a saucy little tweet that I sent out about how basically it was an NDP premier and a Liberal
prime
minister.
I don't think any of your tweets fail to be saucy.
Well, but particularly saucy. And, you know, I got a lot of feedback from conservatives, Michelle Rempel, a bunch of other, you know, conservative MPs basically saying, well, what about Gateway? This is no different than Gateway because the federal, you know, cabinet approved Gateway.
Yeah.
I think the legal landscape is fundamentally different than it was for Gateway. With Gateway, it was a greenfield pipeline. This is obviously an expansion of an existing pipeline. There are issues, you know, the route has shifted a little bit, but it is fundamentally different territory, I think. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to try to litigate the issue of consultation and whether it was done properly. I defer to the courts, and whatever the courts decide is what I will believe.
I'll say that for the record, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a lawyer either. I have a different interpretation of what I think is fair and right, but ultimately I'm going to respect the decision that comes out of the courts.
I mean, the one thing I would say is that, and I understand the Tsleil-Waututh's position, I empathize with it, because the rubber meets the road in their backyard. But there are dozens of First Nations up the project line who do support it and who have signed benefit agreements and who would stand to benefit from its construction and operation. So, you know, the question always comes down in these sorts of situations. It's not, you know, rights aren't absolute. It's a balancing act. You know, section one of the charter is all about, you know, how do you balance different rights? And so I think the question will come down to, you know, how do we balance the rights of the First Nations who are upstream, who support it, against the Tsleil-Waututh and the First Nations in Vancouver who don't, and the government's interests, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that's what the courts are there for, to resolve these issues.
There's an interesting microcosm there of the debate between BC and Alberta, right? Because the farther upstream you are, mm-hmm. the more you stand to benefit and the less you stand to lose, right? The less risk you take. Mm-hmm. The closer you are to the loading terminal, because that's where most spills happen, is where the, you know, tankers are loaded. That's the place where you probably have the least to gain and the most to lose. And so it's not a surprise that as you move west along the route, the British Columbians and First Nations are more and more uncomfortable with that trade-off. And as you move higher up to the, you know, the upstream First Nations that own construction companies in the oil sands, for example, obviously are all for it. Mm-hmm. So the thing about Indigenous rights, though, is that it's not an averaging act. Like, you can't just say, okay, well, there are X number of groups along the pipeline and 55% of them say yes. That's not how title law works. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tricky thing about these long linear projects, is that they are very vulnerable to challenges anywhere along that route. If you have to cross somebody's territory and they say no, it's hard to pump oil around them, right? Like, if there's a hole in your route, you don't have a pipeline. And
yeah,
so that's why I think that they've really brought this issue of title to the fore.
And this was always the problem with Gateway, and it's going to be a problem for any pipeline that they try to push across British Columbia from Alberta, is that it can't be pushed, right? It has to be pulled. It has to be driven by First Nations communities who have not just like a little equity stake, but they own the whole fucking thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's their land, it's their title, it's their, you know, their relationship with the environment that is potentially at risk. And, you know, I still don't think pipeline companies from Alberta completely understand that.
They don't, and they don't understand the legal context in which there are no treaties and people have unalienated underlying title to the land, because in Alberta, people work with the government because it's the best deal available. They signed treaties, their ancestors signed treaties 150 years ago, and so they don't have the same kind of leverage as the nations here. I think you're hearing more agreement between Max and I than disagreement, and hope that's okay, because I know you're hoping for a debate.
But no, it's a conversation more than a debate, I think.
On the rights front, people ask me all the time, like, why don't you have a campaign against LNG, a province-wide anti-fracking campaign? And the main reason is because there is no consensus, and especially not among First Nations. I happen to know that poverty sucks. And if people in a given place weigh the benefits and the risks of a given economic development, and they say that they're on board, I have no business as an urban environmentalist going up and telling them, oh, you're wrong. Like, LNG's wrong. You made a bad decision. There are accountability mechanisms in every First Nation, whether you're talking about elected government or even hereditary leadership. There are ways to hold those people accountable, and you have to trust that they have technical staff and that people are smart enough to read the literature on both sides, come to a political decision, and then either move forward with the project or not. So I will defer to the leadership of those communities on things like LNG projects. And the same goes for pipelines. As much as I might personally have an opinion against, I can't fault the local authorities in any of those nations for looking at the risk-reward and saying, yeah, this benefits our community. But I don't think that that overrides or cancels out the concerns of people who have, in legal speak, presented an informed withholding of consent based on the evidence so far. So what I really hope doesn't happen is that we say, oh, forget it, they're never going to agree, and just push the project through, because that's a recipe for conflict. I do think that there are legal questions to be resolved in the courts, which I will respect. There's a democratic question about, whether people want this thing, and we've suggested a referendum. There might be other mechanisms for gauging public appetite for this project. And then there's the outstanding question about, those individual First Nations. And if those communities say, okay, we don't love it, but we're okay with it, we're not going to stand in the way of it, I'm done. Like, I'm not going to go and stand in front of a pipeline that people want or are okay with. But I think that if we try to rush this through, that we will see, people, there'll be unnecessary conflict.
And the nightmare scenario for me is not so much, the protesters squaring off against bulldozers. It's the courts rendering a verdict that allows the pipeline to be built, and people using that as a reason to undermine,
delegitimize the courts, right,
and present a sort of, an anti-elite, anti-state argument, and say, well, the courts don't matter, they don't get it. And that to me is really, that makes me really nervous, because the courts are ultimately the last bastion of defense.
It's all we've got. We've lost faith in pollsters this year. We've lost faith in democratic institutions, right? We've lost faith in the police. So in terms of institutions upholding liberal Western democracy, once people, do not take the courts seriously, you've got a real problem.
I don't know how you square that. I'm sure there's some people who would categorically refuse to accept any decision from the courts that allowed it to get built. I mean, the thing I would say to them is if you look at the record of, certainly the BC Supreme Court and the Federal Supreme Court and basically any court in Western Canada, First Nations have an astonishing winning streak right now. It's very unusual that they go into court on behalf of their rights and don't come out winning. Mm-hmm. Bill Gallagher, who's he writes about this a lot. He's out of Toronto. He's written a book about it. And his point is that they have like a 237 case winning streak in lower courts.
And
so
that's cumulative, yeah. Right? And in each of those cases adds to the jurisprudence, which strengthens the next case that comes along. And so that's what the essential question will be. From a non-lawyer, is do these people have the right to consent, or is it just consultation and accommodation that the government is bound to? And this is going to be a big one. I don't think we're going to see a title case filed in the Lower Mainland. That would be a little bit too messy. But there are some serious legal hammers in the back pocket of First Nations that want to stop this thing.
Well, I do wonder. It's sort of pointless to litigate it now because it's happening. But, why didn't Kinder Morgan explore, going, out to Tsawwassen maybe, where the First Nation is, I think, a little more okay with industrial development, and there's already a lot happening in that sort of part of the...
They're opposed to Kinder Morgan, which is interesting because their former chief was on the panel reviewing it. Mm-hmm. But, the alternate route scenario was brought up by Rachel Notley as well and quickly retracted. And I think it has to do with the... the legal triggers that you talked about with a greenfield pipeline. The idea of going through a heavily populated area where you don't already have a right-of-way is a recipe for delay.
Yeah.
And so that's unfortunately led them to pick the existing route in most places, which is not 50 years later necessarily the best route, and especially as a place to load Aframax tankers. I mean, you can only fill them three-quarters full because of the tide cycle in Burrard Inlet. If they sit too low, they can't get through under the bridge. And so it's actually making the project less economic. You need higher oil prices for that to even be worthwhile. And so for a multitude of reasons, having the pipeline along its existing 1953 route is actually dumb. But the proponent wanted to get this thing built as quickly as possible with as few legal challenges, and that's why they're using this existing right-of-way.
Well, and there's a big sort of overhang here about sunk costs, where you have a bunch of people. So you have the federal government, you have the government of Alberta, you have the government of BC, you have the proponent, who, you know, they're kind of already all in, and they can't take their chips off the table. So, you know, I think if you could create a space where, you know, they could all kind of get their money back, so to speak, you know, whether it's politically or financially, they would probably take it at this point. But, you know, like, it's one of these things where they're just, you know, they've
in
got
for
most
a penny,
of
in for a pound.
In for, well, but in for like a lot of pennies, in for a pound. So they can't walk backwards. And I think, you know, justifiably, they don't want to walk backwards, because if they do, I think, you know, the ENGO community will seize on that and interpret it as a victory, as an, you know, encouragement and inducement to do more anti-pipeline campaigns, and they do not want that. So there's just a lot of sunk costs in this project already.
Kai, this expansion mm-hmm. is really a twinning of what's there already. Is that right?
Well, it's a new pipeline. It's a 590,000 barrel a day pipeline that mostly follows the right of way from 1953. And so the two important points to remember: one is that there are no plans to replace or upgrade the existing pipe,
yeah.
right, which they've been using for now 63 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic when interveners tried to ask about that at the National Energy Board, the response from Trans Mountain was, well, the Empire State Building is made out of steel, and steel has an effective operational life of infinity,
mm-hmm.
so we don't need to replace it, which makes people nervous who already live, you know, along those aquifers and near the Fraser River, because this thing has popped before. It's old and parts are corroded.
So it has popped before. I mean, this is one thing that I've been wondering about is
yeah, most recently, yeah. you know, in the Coquihalla Canyon, there have been corrosion incidents and leaks, and those are just, you know, as you run pipelines from the 50s at modern pressures with modern products, you got to be really on the spot with your maintenance, or else some of those sections start to rust out and the ground shifts, and you get leaks, right? So that's point one, which is that the existing pipeline, they're not planning to upgrade. Point two is that, yeah, this new pipeline that will be laid along the old route, for legal reasons, is following that existing right-of-way, which means going through all these places that are now heavily populated. But when you talk about First Nations in the 50s and their, you know, the legal tools with which they had to ask for a better deal with this pipeline, they couldn't even hire lawyers. They couldn't mm-hmm. even vote. So using that as a precedent or as an excuse to follow that existing route is a little bit slimy as far as I'm concerned.
Are the environmental concerns, Max, or are they overstated?
I mean, it's a funny question. On the one hand, you know, when you look at the balance of probabilities and the safety record of pipelines, I think they are. But when you understand that these are people who, this is their backyard, this is where they fish, this is where they hunt, this is where they've trapped for, you know, generations, and this is their, you know, the water, English Bay, where they kind of, you know, it's part of their identity. You know, when you say to them, well, there's a, you know, 0.01% chance of a major spill, that's too high, right? And I think people in Alberta don't really understand that it's not that people don't understand the odds, it's that they don't care. You know, any prospect of a major spill is just, it's unacceptable. And so when you sort of go into this conversation with, you know, engineering speak and probabilities and, you know, well, you know, planes crash and we still fly in planes, well, we do, but that's not really the same thing.
Doesn't mean your palms don't sweat when the plane's taking off, right?
Yeah.
So, when you're contemplating, you know, what could I lose, what could my family lose, and where is the information coming from that this is safe, you know, you can't blame people for looking at the track record of a company like Kinder Morgan, or Enbridge for that matter, and saying, okay, but you've screwed up before. And they say, well, that was a specific incident, or that wasn't our fault, or, you know, there's always a reason why. But there's still, you know, pictures of these things gushing black goop into people's rivers and neighborhoods, right? So I agree that pipeline technology has improved since the 50s, and I think that that is a great thing. I agree that it's safer than rail. I agree that, you know, with this much scrutiny, there'd be incentive to build this thing to the highest possible standards. But the same company has also got a pretty extensive track record of buying up basically distressed assets, like old pipeline companies with rusty old infrastructure, and then running the pressure as high as they possibly can until they pop, and then paying the fines. So that's their business model. And that does not inspire confidence. And that's why I wish there'd been more of a sense of a sort of fair broker during the hearing process, to be able to hear from people who didn't have a financial stake on either side of the argument, to talk about the risks and the probabilities, but that didn't happen.
So, sorry, I had a little bit of a burp there. I was not aware. I didn't realize that that they made the argument that because the Empire State Building is made out of steel, then don't worry about it. That's absurd. You're not pumping hydrocarbons at pressure through the Empire State Building. The problem is, it's arguments like that that really, they do so much damage to these companies. You know, like I wish.
Well, we asked them about earthquakes, and they said there hasn't been one in the operational lifetime of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, so the probability of one happening is zero. I was like, that's not how math works, guys. That's not seismology. Like, that's transparently, that's a ridiculous thing. And, you know, especially when the president.
Especially for someone who, you know, people who grew up in Vancouver.
Yeah.
You know that that's not true. No, you know, yeah, that, yeah, that, you know, in whatever risk calculation you're performing, you have to put a weight on a terrible earthquake, because it could totally happen.
The president of Kinder Morgan said recently, you know, I don't know, I'm not smart enough to know if humans are causing climate change. And so every time that you have a statement like this from industry, I mean, it would actually do them less damage if there was a forum in which they could just make their craziest arguments, and then the opponents could make their craziest arguments, and you had some sense that we would get an outcome that balanced the two.
Yeah.
The problem with the Harper system of pipeline reviews, which Trudeau used for this approval, is that it was weighted towards the proponents, so that those more ridiculous arguments, like the Empire State Building one, were never challenged. And there's a sense of a lack of procedural fairness, which makes the outcome of the whole approval suspect for people that were paying attention.
So, I mean, just so I'm clear about my position here, I have no love lost for these pipeline companies. I think a lot of what they've done is of their own making. You know, if they'd hired a few more journalists and put them in communications roles, maybe they wouldn't have communicated.
Hey, a lot
so
of out
poorly.
Of work journalists.
Exactly, it's a renewable resource. But my concern is with the industry in Alberta, the upstream companies, who, you know, because they can't get their product to market as efficiently as possible, they're leaving money on the table. That means tax revenues being left on the table, which means ultimately Canadians are being deprived of resources that are rightfully theirs. So, you know, like, there's a part of me that kind of wishes, again, saying that you support nationalizing things is a dangerous thing. But I think people would have more trust in these pipeline companies if maybe there was a bit more involvement and oversight on the part of the public, where, you know, they were publicly regulated and owned utilities that move product to market, and then they could invest a little more in technology, replace old pipe, do what needs doing, just in BC, because that's where the concerns are, and maybe give British Columbians a bit more certainty that the project is going to be operated
well, like
in their
Hydro
interest.
Well, like BC Hydro or BC Rail, or, you know, we have lots of utilities that move energy and move products around that the public has a stake in. And when a company shows up from Texas and says, trust us, this is a great deal for you, by the way, we're going to find every possible tax instrument we can to funnel money out of your country and into our pockets, it's just hard to believe that they have your best interests at heart.
So this goes to another thought that I've had in thinking about all of this in recent days. As a citizen, as a media consumer, as a voter, how do I wade through all the stuff that I'm being told by both sides, or all sides, really, on this issue? I mean, what do you guys do? I mean, you're pretty informed on all stuff. I mean, what do you rely upon?
Well, it's too much to realistically ask any normal person to, you know, do a degree in media criticism and then read every single available source and then make a decision. I think ultimately it is going to come down to a question about values and credibility, right? And who do you trust? And oftentimes, you know, people being mammals, we trust the ones that we live with and share our genetics or our geography. So, you know, the most credible source on these issues is usually the person who's your neighbor or your friend or your family member. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing, but that's just how people interpret the world. So I don't know. I think the ultimate decision is going to hinge on people's values and what they consider their priorities. And if it's about material insecurity, like I said earlier, if people are if they believe that this pipeline is in the best interests of their family financially, they'll support it. And if it's a threat to their home or their values, or they don't trust the people that are promoting it, then I think that you'll see a rejection from people in BC.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of things in politics, it's kind of a Rorschach test for people. It's what do you value, what do you care most about, and that will inform how you sort through the information and the evidence and come to a conclusion. I mean, my only sort of recommendation would be to not demonize people on the other side. You know, that whatever people might think, and this is true for both sides, this is true for the people who think that anyone who supports a pipeline is an ecological terrorist, and it's true for people who think that those who oppose pipelines are ecological terrorists, right? It just doesn't help to inflame the debate that way. There are good reasons to support it. There are good reasons to oppose it. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we need to respect the choices that other people make. This isn't like, you know, someone who's a Trump supporter. Like, that's indefensible in my view, you know. although, I'm kind of kidding. I can see it. But this is, you know, reasonable people can disagree, so let's be reasonable.
And are you hopeful that the discourse will, say, raise itself, or is it just...
Oh, no. No, it's going straight into the gutter.
I don't know. We're doing our small bit. I will say for the record that Max has waded in on Twitter to defend me from, you know, randos calling me an eco-terrorist because I live in Vancouver and have opinions that run counter to theirs, you know, farther up the pipeline, and vice versa. I've pried a few people's fingers from around Max's throat on online because he, you know, he's willing to argue publicly in favor of pipeline, therefore he must be evil. So, yeah, I mean, I think that conversations like this are hopefully a good start. Both of those opinions are legitimate. Like, I can disagree with Max, but I understand that his system of values, his training and education, and his position in this debate rationally have led him to support this project. And that is something that I'm not going to talk him out of by, you know, trying to get him to adopt my values or prioritize my concerns. So we have to be willing to accept the fact that our fellow citizens are going to disagree. What I hope for and pray for is a forum, whether that's in the courts or whether that's and, you know, in the form of a referendum or some kind of a, you know, a test that people participate in and take seriously, that will answer this question so that we can move on, because there's a lot of other things that we need to be putting our brain power towards, like having Trump in the White House, like the ongoing climate crisis, like the kind of big picture stuff that we should be tackling rather than just fighting each other for years over a pipeline.
And I mean, it's funny, you know, when I'm in Vancouver, I'm the bad guy on this issue.
You like that, though.
I do. I enjoy it. But in Alberta, I'm the good guy, right? You know, in Alberta, I'm a lefty. In BC, I'm a righty. And it's been instructive to me to go through that experience, because I think it's something that certainly the industry in Alberta needs to do more of, which is just try to understand why people oppose this rather than just arguing them out of their position. You know, like, go, you know, they should be sending all their executives to Vancouver for, like, you know, a month retreat.
Hollyhock.
Well, yeah, okay, but or even just, you know, walk around downtown Vancouver, just talk to people so they can understand that these are legitimate concerns, and every time you try to dismiss them as illegitimate, you make them more strident, you make them more sort of, you embed them more in people's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the days of it, of the industry being able to ram projects through, and the days of it being run by engineers, they better be over, because the last 10 years should have been a wake-up call that you need to learn how to communicate, to listen, and to engage with people in ways that's more than just showing up with some trinkets and a PowerPoint presentation. Time will tell whether that lesson has sunk in. When I go back to Alberta, I still have to fight with people when I, you know, to explain that people who oppose pipelines are not bad people. They're not crazy. They're not irrational. And you have to listen to them.
They're not trying to strangle unborn Albertan babies. But that's where the discussion often goes. And so it's interesting watching Max try to walk between those two worlds, right? Because I have a very clear regional identity, right? My family's been here since 1900. I'm British Columbian before I'm Canadian.
Right.
And especially given the internment experience, that tested our allegiance, right, to the to the Canadian flag. So I don't have to, you know, I don't have to question where I sit in this debate. But I watch Max go back to Calgary, and the frustration when the people who support you on the issue are psychos, you know, I deal with that too. But just watching, you know, people like Kelly Leach, you know, campaigning on the idea of let's lock them up, let's create a special pipeline Gestapo and lock up all the people like Kai, right? And Max has to go back to Alberta and say, okay, so even though we agree on the issue, you're an asshole and you're actually undermining the case for the pipeline by linking it to your whatever racist campaign promises or other authoritarian tendencies. And so not an enviable position, but I respect the fact that you are willing to go and have those battles with people on both sides of the debate.
Whether you're a British Columbian or an Albertan, at what point do you consider the Canadian part of this? And do you wonder if this issue could split the country up?
So I'm sort of the opposite of Kai in that I could not give a lick about which province I'm in. I don't have a provincial identity. I'm a Canadian. I'm a Canadian first, and I always have been. So what I think draws me to this issue is that there is a sense of national interest at play here. And I happen to believe, like, you know, my sort of political icon, person I, you know, fell in love with in university, Pierre Trudeau. I make no bones about that, although it makes life in Alberta hard sometimes.
You know who my political icon is?
Who?
Preston Manning.
Ah.
That explains a lot about our
really
debate,
does.
There you
right?
go.
Yeah.
yeah.
But I think that national interests are important, and, you know, the thing I like about Justin Trudeau is that he appears to be willing to pay a price to pursue a national interest. Do I think it could split the country up? No. I'm just sort of always skeptical of these. We're going to have a sovereignty movement. You know, they tried it in Alberta. It's a joke. It'll never get more than 10 or 15%. They can try it in Saskatchewan. It's a good, you know, political strategy for whipping up sort of your base if you're on the right, I suppose. Like, will BC separate if the pipeline gets built? I doubt it. I think British Columbians, they do have, you know, a very strong provincial identity, but I just think that the costs and the trauma of actually pursuing a separatist path are too great for most people to bear. But I defer to Kai here because he worked in Quebec. He saw this up close and personal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there isn't. Maybe Cascadia is a thing that could happen. Who knows?
I don't think in the short term that anyone's seriously talking about this fracturing the Federation, but I do think that, you know, this week we saw again the strains of trying to work together in this sort of big, abstract, mushy landmass that we call Canada, where people's regional interests might be diametrically opposed, and then it's up to the federal government to try to broker some kind of a compromise so that we continue to enjoy the benefits of working together. And I do believe that, you know, that there are good reasons why all of these provinces and populations would work together and continue to work together. But the history of nation states, I think the average lifespan of a country is something like 80 years. Like, Canada's already an old man by international standards. And the more you try to hold together a coalition like that across such broad geography with a tolerant, liberal, Western democratic system, you know, the more you have to get people to believe in some shared sense of national identity. And I think that pipeline projects and debates like this do erode that. They pit regional interests against each other, and long term, that's not great for the project of Canada. So, yeah, I think you're right. Trudeau is willing to take some serious political heat for this. If I was being uncharitable, I would say that he's simply more motivated by the arguments that have been made by the lobbyists and foreign governments that support this project, and, you know, the domestic political hit he thinks he can make up in the next 3 years. But yeah, it's something that definitely puts a strain on any national leader who has to broker you know, opposite viewpoints between people in two parts of the country.
I mean, the flip side of that is that if Trudeau came out and said, all right, no pipelines, this isn't, you know, or at least, you know, Line 3, sure, Keystone, sure, you know, Trans Mountain, not happening, that would sort of pour a little bit of gasoline on the Western separatists, the Alberta,
oh, yeah,
you know, the people who want to make that in Saskatchewan its own sort of, you know, its own polity. So it, you know, that's the challenge of national governance, is that there's always things that are pulling in these different directions, and you have to sort of balance out, you know, will the pull in one direction be sort of, you know, counteracted by the pull in the other direction? And I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. But I think if we don't remind people of the existence and importance of national objectives, it's going to be hard to make that case when it becomes important. You know, it won't resonate.
Yeah. So it's one thing to be on one side and to have, you know, to be on either side of this issue. But what do you say to people who don't care, who are apathetic or worse, indifferent to all of this? Because there are a lot of people like that, right? There are a lot of people who aren't like you two guys.
Yeah.
Who aren't following this.
I mean, they're not listening, so I guess we can insult them. but, no, I mean, seriously, the job of if you have a point to make or a project to build or a election to win, you have to reach those people and you have to make your project relevant to them. And so, you know, what we do at Dogwood is try to engage people who share a certain set of values and a geographic identity, right? Primarily, this is about place-based politics, and we try to talk about what we have in common as British Columbians and get those people invested in political decision making, you know, get them to participate in elections, in leadership races, and in project reviews. And that's an uphill battle, but we have had a lot of success with this issue. It's one reason we still campaign on it, is because people, this makes it real for them. You know, their investment in politics and their participation in politics very well could shape the outcome of this project, which for a lot of people threatens their values, their priorities, their home. And so that's one of the things that was kind of disappointing about the federal approval for this project, is that we got a lot of people out to vote in the last federal election who otherwise would not show up at the polls. A lot of people who didn't have a fixed address, or people who are young or just disengaged from politics, and we're trying to give them a reason to believe in their individual participation in this system, and to have their worst fears realized, and the Prime Minister turns around and says, you know, like, didn't really mean it with those promises, and I'm actually going to, you know, do the opposite of what you thought I was going to do. That's unfortunate, because it just reinforces the broad feeling that politicians are liars and they just say what they need to do to get elected, and it reduces the likelihood that those people will vote in the next election. So it's too bad. We're trying to fight cynicism, but sometimes feels like an unwinnable battle.
I mean you don't try to engage with indifferent people online, do you?
No, it's just one of the natures of social media, is that it's hard to reach people who don't give a shit. Because they're not there. But
that does concern you, though, that a lot of people are tuned out on this issue.
You know what? I understand why some people are tuned out on it, when you have two sides that appear to be kind of shouting at each other in the media. That can be a little bit off-putting for people. And you know, people have busy lives. They have mortgages to pay. They have kids to raise. So not everyone has the free time to get so involved and so passionate about an issue. I think, as of just a general sort of position, people should always be engaged in public life and should participate in democracy. But that can take a number of different forms. You shouldn't feel obligated to care about an issue just because other people do. And you shouldn't feel bad when people tell you that you should care about it and you don't. And also, being in favor of this project in Vancouver kind of makes you a pariah. So I suspect there's a number of people out there who are quiet supporters of this, but just don't stand up and talk about it, because there's a social cost. There's a penalty that you can pay. I mean, you know, I'm sure this isn't going to help me get any dates with people who hate pipelines. Not that I was going to date them anyways,
you get him to fix you up with someone.
I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. But I mean, I think we need to be careful about seeing politics purely through our own eyes. So, you know, I may get involved in something because I want a certain political outcome. But this is a country full of millions of people who may have other priorities. And just because we don't get what we want doesn't mean that we should turn our backs on the process. Now, I understand when people promise things, when politicians promise to do things and then they don't do them, that upsets people. And it should. I mean, you know, if I was advising an elected official, I would say try to stay away from making promises, because if you don't live up to them, it hurts you and it undermines people's trust in the process. You know, make commitments to doing things a certain way, to, you know, transparency, to openness, all that kind of stuff. But if you're going to go out and say I will do X and then you don't do X, be prepared to pay a price.
Gentlemen, this has been fun and illuminating for me. I appreciate you both coming in to do this.
Yeah,
we should do this again.
This is the longest conversation that we've probably ever had about pipelines, and it didn't end in blows. So I think that this is a great step forward.
Well, Ezra Levant is down the hall, and he's just I'll signal for him to come in here, and
that is
can both take him on.
That is the next step, is bringing Ezra in here.
At Kindagata and at Max Fawcett, or the Twitter handles Max Fawcett and Kindagata. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.